ॐ सहनावतु सहनौ भुनक्तु सह वीर्यं करवावहै तेजस्विनावधीतमस्तु मा विद्विषावहै। ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः। Over to you, Rick.
So we seem to be a smaller group today. everyone that's here, did you all have the opportunity to see all three talks?
I
yes.
did. Yeah.
Everyone
yes.
did?
Two of no, them. I have not. I have not seen all the videos. I just listened to the first one.
Okay.
Anyway.
So my suggestion is after today, and I think regardless if you've heard one or three, listen to them again. I think they'll be charged as a result of today's talk. At any rate, let me just say, I mean, why did I choose these talks, or why was I excited about these talks? And it's really because of the content. But aside from that, seeing Swamiji in 1976 when his beard is completely black, and he's in his mid-40s, he's at a camp in Piercy, where the course, the Northern California course, would start 3 years later. So he's not in a public talk. He's at a group. He's with people who have one who are there because they want deeper and more intense study with Swamiji. And that gives him a certain permission, I believe, in this talk, in the way he handles the material, the depth and the in one sense, the speed or rhythm of which he goes through it. Also, when he sings Henry VIII, I am, which I have seen him do. I wasn't at these talks. I met him 3 years later. But it is, Swamiji had this amazing ability to not only be able to teach to anyone, but to be able to do it in a way that he could lighten the whole audience. He could lighten the mood, no matter how deep he took it. And I always, and you know, that was a way of letting people take a breath and come back to what he was teaching and not just feel bang, 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 because it can be very intense. Also, I want to say here, I went back and re-listened, and I made notes this time of the three talks. And I don't know, you tell me your own experience, but when I would sit with Swamiji, particularly when he was doing a vision type talk, it's very hard to retain. I think it's hard to retain because you're so in the present, in the moment. You're not filtering. You're not analyzing. You're just there with it. So how are you going to retain it? So I find that, and I made notes for that reason, if people wanted to dilate particular moments of it. That being said, he does start with where instruction often starts with, and that's drisha, subject, object, seer, seen. I also, just as an aside here, was interesting with Swamiji because it's like he could start anywhere and end up with the self, like starting at any point in the circumference of a circle and reaching the center. He could take anything and weave his way to truth. Sorry, I have to do this. Okay. So he starts there, and then he goes into the nature of the awarer, awareness, and into a discussion of time and the true nature of time. Then he, in the second tape, he gets into really the depth of unfolding Sat Chit Ananda. But the way he does it is to say what all activity in life, you can trace it back to one of these three: looking for immortality, flip side, fear of death, looking for not to be ignorant, looking for knowledge, and looking for happiness, not being content with suffering. He also makes the point here that we've all experienced our height. And once you've experienced your height, you can't accept anything else. And he does it both in terms of talking about deep sleep, because in deep sleep, we have no world, we have no body, we have no mind, we have no experience, yet we are very much there. In fact, it was one of those things for me when I first heard Swamiji talk, and he talked about how in the morning to say, I had a good sleep, you had to have been there. And not in a awareful way, but you were there knowing that nothing else was, but you were. And he also speaks of it in terms of a moment of joy. I don't know, if you notice, Swamiji does not like to use the word bliss. He'll use the word joy, but more often he'll use the word wholeness, fullness, completeness, because it's such a charged word. And he felt that people would thought that there was like a enlightened bliss, some special bliss. And he didn't want to make that a goal or that some people would talk about. So he talks about and along this line of the three motivators in life, what we're really searching for moment to moment. He would say sometimes people would ask him, do you need Vedanta to live a life? And he would say, no. The purpose of life is to live. Everyone wants to live and live happily. But then he would say, but if you want to live happily, you have to understand Vedanta. Because without knowing who you are, you will have moments, without a doubt. No one is denied moments of happiness and joy. But you will also have suffering. You will also have the pain that goes with ignorance. And there's quite a large discussion here about the nature of happiness, which I think is a very, very good discussion and very something to be taken to heart. He also talks about the idea of that thoughts are the problem and that we want to be without thoughts. And he talks about how for the yogi, this is a nightmare, because who can be without thoughts? But then he says in the midst of that, but I'm aware of my thoughts and all thoughts die. Every thought dies for the next one to come. So what is this? How is, again, the thought going to disable or limit the knower of the thought? Because the thought dies away and you remain. And of course, between two thoughts, the silence that is before, during, and after. Anyway, and at the end, he talks about, without really discussing it, the role of the guru, because he says, people will ask, can I do this? Do I have this? Can I find knowledge? Do I have the tools? Do I have the ability? And Swamiji says here, as he would always say, well, if it was something outside of you, then that's a valid discussion. But if it is you, what separates you from yourself? And Swamiji would say, a real guru never puts distance between you and your goal and never posits himself as the bridge. But he would do that from time to time for people who were willing to take him, to surrender to him, of course. But his point was, this is a journey of the self to the self. And the guru's role is simply to hold up the mirror and reflect to you so you can see for yourself what you are. Okay, that's my introduction. Anyone want to take a portion of it which you either enjoyed or want to discuss more?
No, yeah. I think.
Go ahead. Please go ahead.
No, I think Rick. I attest what you say, and I think you summarized it very well in very broad heads. And I too went through the lectures, once, twice, maybe a little more times, and I realized that unless and until one take notes, it's very difficult to comprehend what is being said. Otherwise, it just
I found it very intense, but at the same time, very fast. So I needed to actually sort of mull over what was being spoken and also reflect on it, because I think that's where. So broadly, I think I also came up with the same thing. I think the first thing he starts about Kshetra and Kshetrajna, right? He refers to the Kshetra as the field of experience, because when you look at, most of the times, sometimes we understand the Kshetra to be the body, but it's not just the body. It is a field of experience. So therefore, it not just covers the body, but it also the mind, the senses, everything else other than just the knower. So that was one take which I had. And what was interesting that he said was the confusion actually starts only when it starts from the body, right? Anything outside of the body is taken as an object of the world. You don't consider it to be yourself. But I think the confusion actually starts when you limit yourself to this body and then say, hey, this is what I am, but you're actually the Kshetrajna. So I think that clarity was very interesting for me to say that the confusion starts actually with the body, right? And I think then he brings out very clearly that, Drik and Drishya, right? The knower and the known and the subject and the object. And then he refers to basically the subject as, the Chit and the Chaitanyam and awareness. And I think he brings out two properties there very nicely and clearly the way he analyzes it. That awareness is not limited by space and time. I think he brings out those two points very clearly. Yeah. I think going forward, I think he's spoken about the fact that everything that we relate to awareness, whatever we are today, it is the awareness with respect to the body and mind which makes the waker. The awareness with respect to the mind without the body makes the dreamer. And the awareness with respect to ignorance of any experience as a deep sleeper. So everything is in relation to this. So I think there was a nice analogy of bringing in the relationship of awareness to avasthitrayam. Yeah. And he also brings about the point saying that the self-loss is limitless because, you are immortal, but because you're limiting yourself, you are therefore having a sense of mortality. And then the struggle actually begins, right? So I think that was a interesting point that he made. And of course, those three things that everyone seeks in life, one is to obviously be immortal, which is like, I want to live a day more, that he brings about. The second one is to have the curiosity of knowing, which is basically the desire to know and desire for knowledge. And the third one is to desire to be happy. I think these are the few points I made out of the discussions, but I think quite deep, intense, and it was a good exercise for me. Yeah, thank you.
Yeah. Awesome, Subbu. Yeah, those three things that everybody that is commonly wanted, he relates those to Sat, Chit, and Ananda, right? He corresponds to those, and that I thought was the highlight of the entire talk. Yeah, and I also like that how he explains that awareness could not have been born in time, because everything that's born in time will have an end. But, if you think of what is now and then you subdivide it into, this minute, this second, this, this millisecond, nanosecond, etc., then awareness is something which is beyond any fraction of time, and therefore it is beyond time itself.
True.
Yeah, a couple of points. Once again, it was truly enjoyable. And Rick, as you pointed out, every time you listen to it, you are so in the moment that you just float with it. It's hard to retain. And I had the same experience. And I kept going back saying, when I listened, it was so clear. And why am I not able to retain it? And then went back, because this is the first time I heard someone explain Satchidananda, and I actually understood, especially Sat and the Sat part and the Chit part. I mean, it was, yes, we have read and we kind of intellectually understand conscious awareness, but the way he explained it with respect to space and time was just amazing, right? And Sat was also, it was something that blew my mind in terms of the first time I fully kind of, I think, getting close to understanding it. Let's put it that way. I'm sure I have to go back a few more times to fully get my head around it, to be able to explain to other people in layman terms, right? So amazing talk, no doubt. With respect to that, I really like the way he said that all events like birth and death happens in time, which means time supersedes that, right? Time encompasses that. But then awareness encompasses time, right? And then he proves that through breaking it down. So which means that awareness is beyond time, right? And also with respect to Sat, he says anything that does not change. So, and then connects it back to conscious awareness, something that does not undergo change, right? And hence there's no birth and death. So a amazing talk. The one that I wanted to kind of hone in a little bit is one of my favorite topics, which is that of happiness, which he goes into fair bit of detail in the second video. I'm very happy to hear that, in fact. As you know, as he rightly pointed out, there is the pursuit of happiness, right? I mean, we all in some ways pursue happiness. However, that is a mistake. We pursue it outside, right? And he explains it really well, that there is no denying the fact that there are moments when we experience that level of joy, right? There are certainly moments. But then we incorrectly attribute it to the source of the happiness. We incorrectly attribute it to the people, place, thing, situation that we were in, right? Because before that situation happened, we were in a certain state. And when that situation happened, we suddenly became very joyful. And hence, well, it must be that situation that made must be the source of joy, right? So we kind of incorrectly, the attribution is where the mistake happens. We can't deny that if we experience it, but the attribution is wrong. So then what exactly happens is that as he points, uses the word, there is a gap in the mind. So to me, the way I relate to that is that the mind is in a very extremely contented, fulfilled, calm state, and it's not asking for anything. There's no craving. There is no aversion. You just don't want to get rid of anything. You don't want anything either. You are in that very, very stable state. A system that is in a very stable state is at rest, right? Is in a place where it's supposed to be, is in one with its true nature, any system for that matter, right? So in this case, mind, when it's in that state, is able to reflect its the true nature, which is conscious awareness getting reflected in the mind, right? So those gaps are there in our lives. Those do happen, few and far in between, and we say it is okay, because that's how it is. But the whole point of this talk, again, one part of its talk was, don't be satisfied with it being okay to have those gaps every now and then. Why can't it be long lasting or permanent is then the question. So because that is the nature, why do you compromise, right? So but if you have to, then you need to get to that state, and then you don't have to acquire it from outside. The source is inside. It's just that the mind needs that gap to be able to reflect that happiness, and then that is within you, right? So to me, that was a reinforcement, a validation, and definitely a insightful part, which is that something that people, I think, can relate to, right? This is where it can connect with normal people, because every one of us wants to be happy. I mean, nobody can deny that. And yes, everyone will connect with it. So the way if somebody is interested in talking about Vedanta or yoga, the way I connect with them is by starting with at the point of happiness, because everyone understands it. And then say, hey, what is the source of happiness? We incorrectly attribute it, but where is, what is happiness, and why do we wrongly attribute it? It's coming from inside. So it is then, the understanding is basically that, hey, source of happiness is not outside, it is inside you, and that it is in well within your control. So you don't have to feel that your situation is causing you to be unhappy, but you can be unhappy regardless of any, everything that's that you're in right now, right? So that part I thoroughly enjoyed, obviously, and from the understanding of Satchit and Ananda was a key takeaway. So I'll keep going back to this until I feel I have completely assimilated and I can explain it to people in layman terms. And that to me would be the litmus test.
So Kishor, I might recommend honestly that as you listen next time, you make notes.
Notes, okay.
Just because when you go back to them, it'll bring you back to what the vision is. But let me, if I may, for a moment, I'm also and was very drawn to happiness as a approach to Vedanta, as both from the outside, but also from the inside. So if we dilate a moment of happiness, and it is regardless of the source, whether it's an ice cream cone or a sunset or your child, whatever be the apparent source of happiness, an achievement, reaching a goal. But in a moment of happiness, what really happens? The mind resolves. It's not a state of mind. The mind resolves. Samsara is at a standstill. The wanting self is in that moment consumed. It is the self alone with the self, awareness aware of itself. We are that happiness. And that's why he does the amazing example. I love this, of the dog with the bone. And the dog is chewing the bone, and the bone has no meat. But the dog, unaware, pokes himself, and the blood he's sucking is himself. And he's enjoying it immensely. And he can't believe his good fortune to have found the bone and with the meat. But it's the exact same thing we all do. And Swamiji goes on to say, because we don't recognize what's actually occurring, then we just move on to the next desire. And I would also like to just add to that, who taught anyone that they should pursue happiness? Who taught you that? Nobody taught you that. Because in accepting that we are anything, by accepting any limitation, sorrow being one of them, it's not comfortable. You can't be comfortable in a straitjacket, whether put on by someone else or put on by yourself. It's never going to feel right. And that's the point he makes. You know, the spiritual search is not something you choose to do. It's something you have no choice over. But again, I will go back to, I love Buddha's comment on this. There's really only two issues with spirituality or the spiritual path. One is not getting on it, and one is not completing it. So, but the other thing is that when he talks about existence and time here, Swamiji doesn't go into it as much in this talk, but what he talks about is we only know existence as something that is existent. So everything that is born in time, existing in time, dying in time, that's how we think of existence. But what we're really thinking about is something that's existent. It has a birth, it has a period in which it thrives or survives, and then it goes away. That's not existence. That is manifestation. That is creation, if you will. But what he talks about here with existence is that when he's talking about time, and he's saying the present moment, and we were talking about how you can subdivide it and subdivide it. So his definition of the present is that which cannot be subdivided. Well, when you get to that which cannot be subdivided, the only thing that remains is awareness. We objectify time. Time does not objectify us. And just along this too, in his beautiful discussion of awareness, I would add to this where he has talked about before, what do you do to be aware? Is there any yogic pose required for being aware? Is there any mental exercises one must complete to be aware? No, we find ourselves aware. And whatever we're aware of, the world, the senses, the mind, memories, imagination, whatever we're aware of, the awareness itself is not affected by what we're aware of. Well, how can that be? It is because awareness has no form. That's why we talk about it as formless. And because it's formless, it's limitless. All forms are subject to the threefold limitation of time, born in time, existing in time, dying in time. All forms, physical forms, are subject to space. They have a location. And all form, in order to be a particular form, has attributes. Attributes, of course, are subject to time. But awareness has no attributes, has no form. So being, it is by definition, timeless, spaceless, formless. All is objectified or known by awareness. All exist in awareness, but awareness itself never comes into being. And he talks about this also in the sense of when we go to sleep at night, we fear death, but what we fear, of course, is that we will be no more. But every night we will let go of the world. Every night we let go of the mind. And when we let go of the world and mind, we still very much are. And as I really do believe that life is a macrocosm of the microcosm that we are. And that's why Vedanta is an examination of our own experience, because it's non-different. It reveals who we are. There's nothing we have to, you're not creating anything to be who you are. You're just recognizing what you already are. And when we recognize that, we also realize we cannot be apart from it ever. And the notion that we're apart from it, the suffering, the individuality, it's all notional. There's no basis for it other than ignorance and error. That's also exactly what Buddha said. All that we suffer from is ignorance and error. In the Buddhist samsara circle of life, in the middle, there's a cock, a pig, and a snake. And they stand for ignorance, passion, and desire. When we have ignorance, we're going to have desire because we're not going to accept the self-imposed limitations. We're going to passion, his discussion about passion is that passion is, it's like poison. You think you're going to poison someone else, but you become poisoned by your association with the poison. In the same way, passion is very obscuring. Doesn't make it more real. It's just obscuring. And so in Buddhism, they concentrate on the desire side and the emotion side, but it's all just as Swamiji has done here. It all comes back to ignorance, self-ignorance. And the fact that it's unacceptable is because we know that.
Thank you, Rick. Really, well explained. Yeah. Thank
you. So I'm sure you also said, he was asked by this physicist at Berkeley, he was doing talks, and the physicist wanted to know, can you define truth? And Swami said, yes, I can define truth. He said, you can define truth? How can you define truth? If you define truth, you're making an object. Truth can't be something known objectively. Swami says, I can define truth. So he tells him that which cannot be negated, that which cannot be negated in all three times, past, present, future, is the truth. You can negate the world. You do it when you go to sleep. You can negate the mind. You do it in deep sleep. But you can't negate the negator. He talks about this too. You can't dismiss the dismisser. That is you. That is awareness. That is always free.
You showed the explanation of sat. I at least correlated it to being eternal. Because it is awareness is not bound by time and it is beyond time, right? Therefore, it is eternal, and that is the definition of eternal. He says it is, eternal does not mean continuing forever, it is being beyond time.
Okay.
And I somehow correlated that to the definition of Sat. Sat being the truth, or it is existing always. So that's how I related Sat. Chit, he says that you want to know things, right? You want to be you want to get rid of ignorance always. That one was the Chit, and Ananda was you want to be happy. That was the Ananda part.
Absolutely. I always had a tough time understanding existence, right? It was consciousness, yes. It could get it, but not existence. I was finding it hard. But the way he explained it was it's Sat, right? Sat as in Satyam, the truth, that and that doesn't, that which does not change over time. It's not about being continuously the same over time, because that's still on the time axis. We have to be outside of the time axis. That way, the way he explained it was really, really good. Yeah.
Yes, he does discuss that. This is in the first talk, really, almost at the end of it. He talks about how time cannot stand apart from awareness. The real content of time is myself. You can dismiss the three states of experience. You cannot dismiss the dismisser. That awareness itself, into which all three can resolve. What you see, you can dismiss. What you are cannot be dismissed. Note, the subject cannot be dismissed, not the subject. And the subject is not subject to any change. That is what is known as Satyam or Sat. So I equals awareness Chit, and it is also Sat. That which abides in all three periods of time, that which eludes the hands of time, called Satyam or real or Sat. And when we say awareness is, that's Sat and Chit. And the Ananda or Anantam is what makes it limitless. Mm-hmm. So existence not related to birth in time, awareness without form is fullness, wholeness, awareness is. You've covered Sat and Chit, and the Anantam is what makes it limitless. And again, it's just Lakshana. It's not three things, of course.
And I really loved that part where he talks about, you have the knower and you remove the known from the knower. Then what is, right? That was really... very, very intriguing when I heard it, and the two times I heard it, it was very, very intriguing. What remains when you take the known from the knower is the awareness. That was really wonderful.
Yeah,
and you're right, Rick. He was on fire through this entire talk. The liveliness with which he speaks was just amazing. He was just going on like, it was, he owned the entire space, right? At that time, he was like, he's the authority over the subject. He did not flinch, or he did not show any sign of, a doubt or not being convinced about what he was talking. He was like so much into it, and I thought that was really mesmerizing.
He does it all without any kind of notes, I've asked him too when he goes to do these talks. I went to a number of public talks with him, organized a number of them when he was in the Bay Area. And I would ask him, well, do you know what you're going to talk about today? No. When I get in front and I sit in front of the audience, I'll see what's important to them and I'll talk. The only time, it's different if he's going to do a chapter from the Gita or something, but in these public talks, that's often what he would do. But I remember one time we went to Berkeley. This is Berkeley, right? And he liked talking in Berkeley and Stanford because he felt he had a very educated audience, which was true. And we went to Berkeley and he wrote up on the blackboard, Satyam, Yantam, Anantam, Brahman. And he said, by the end of tomorrow, you'll understand that. again, complete confidence.
Actually, not from the top, but if I may add, the complete definition of Satyam is that it doesn't have space, time, and item limitation. And it doesn't have any sajatiya, vijatiya, and swagat bhed. So there are three types of differences which are absent in any truth. And this is the complete definition of truth. And the reason I say that 2 is equal to 2 is always true, because it doesn't belong to any time. You can say it's true, but 2 and 2 is equal to 2 doesn't fit into the entire definition of Satyam. It has limitation of, it has sajatiya bhed. So 2 equal to 2 is same as 9 equal to 9 is same as, so there are many of the same category. And hence 2 equal to 2 is not a truth.
Okay.
It's not the truth.
So sajatiya means it has to be unique.
So it can only be one, because it doesn't have sajatiya bhed, it doesn't have vijatiya bhed, and it doesn't have swagat bhed. So sajatiya bhed is in a species, you have many. So that's what it is like, 2 equal to 2, 9 equal to 9, they all belong to the set of integers and they are equating themselves. So it doesn't have any sajatiya bhed, meaning it needs to be just one. Vijatiya is that it cannot be one of each species. So you cannot have one truth of this type and then another truth which belong to a different category. And then swagat is it cannot have parts. So a truth is which has no space, item, and time limitation. And that's why I think use of word eternal assumes there is time. And that's why he was trying to explain that it's beyond time. So you cannot even call it eternal. Eternal assumes time. So I think that's why it said no space, time, and item limitation, no sajatiya, vijatiya, and swagat bhed. So that's the definition of sat in
you
its
have
entire.
English word equivalents of these three.
Sajatiya terms? Is not of the same. I'll look it up, but it's not of a particular species. It's not that there is one from each species and it doesn't have any parts. Swagat is like we have hands. So the truth doesn't have parts. It's niravya.
Okay. That's wonderful. And also, like you explained yeah. 2 equal to 2 as an example. Yeah. If we can get examples for the other aspects as well, that it can be divided or that it can in different realities, that'll also help us, you know, digest this because it is important to have a complete definition of sat, right? It is.
And then chit is what knows itself and it knows other than itself. That is chit, definition of chit as per the Vedanta. In many of the Upanishads, what it comes.
Say that again.
What knows itself and it knows other than self also. So the reason it's important to include it knows itself is because it is Swaprakash. And then because of the consciousness or the awareness, we can know others. So knows itself and it knows others too. That's the definition.
Is there another?
There isn't, because that is covered in Sat. But mithya category,
okay,
it knows others because it's also the reflected consciousness sort of knows others. So to include that, because that's consciousness, mithya. It includes both the sides. It knows itself and it knows other than self. And then anandam is actually, punam. So there is, because, and that's the reason they all are one, because it is only one. There's nothing outside it. Hence, it is complete. And hence, it is anandam, because there's no desire for anything else. Or because there are other types of anandas, which are like Vishaya Ananda, Bhajana Ananda. Those type of anandas are more objective one. But the one that Satchit Anand refers to is the completeness. There's nothing outside. So that's why these three are linked, because Sat will result in just oneness. And because it is just one, so the consciousness is self-effulgent. It's Swaprakash, because it knows itself, because there's nothing other than itself. It knows itself and it is one. There's nothing outside it. So it is whole. It is Purnam. And that is Ananda. So that Satchit Anand, that's why, is just one thing. The three of them in the definition will only result in just one thing, which is from the angle of different, say from time, we say it is eternal. Those adjectives we use to negate what we tend to think of it to be. Otherwise, it is just one thing. So these three are not different things. Neither are these three gunas. So those are the three definitions I thought I'll just share. But yeah, no, loved his talk, but yeah, couldn't retain and didn't have time to write notes. So I was just trying to complete it so that I do it. But he did cover it very, very beautifully.
Wonderful, Arpana. Thank you.
Rick, I didn't get the reference that he makes to Henry VIII. Maybe I didn't research it. What exactly is the story of Henry VIII?
Henry VIII is a song. It's a pop song from the 60s. I believe it's Herman's Hermits. I'm Henry VIII, I am. And he sings it. And I got married to the widow next door. Everyone was a Henry. She wouldn't have a Willie or a Sam. So Henry VIII, I am. He's the eighth husband. All the prior husbands were Henry. So he's the eighth. But then Swamiji also says, after he sings the song, he says, let me find this. This is so cute. So before he sings the song, he's talking about all the relative roles we play. To the father, you know, to my son, I'm a father, to my father, I'm a son, all of that. And then after he sings it, he says, if he looks at himself from the other seven fellows, then he's Henry VIII. But if I look at myself from the vantage point of myself, I am a simple Henry, not Henry VIII. And it's, you know, when he breaks into song like that and the crowd just erupts, I mean, yes, his owning the crowd. And the thing also with Swamiji is, yes, he was amazing teaching Bhashya, but he could do it just like this, you know, without any kind of real terminology. I mean, I will say that's why I like Rupert Spira too, if you ever listen to him on YouTube, because although he's classically trained in Advaita and in Buddhism, he really speaks free of any of it. And I think it, particularly in the West, makes it much more accessible.
What's the name again, Rick? The second
Rupert, question. Rupert Spira, Spira. He lives in London or in England somewhere.
Sorry, coming back to this Henry VIII, the song is by which group, you say?
Herman's Hermits.
Okay. Okay.
Mrs. Brown was another one of their songs. They were part of the British invasion. So it puts them in like 64 to 67, that kind
of. So they're contemporaries of Beatles and all those. Okay.
And also British, part of the British invasion.
Okay.
But they wrote silly songs that somehow people really liked.
So I wonder, was Swamiji living in the US at the time for some time? No. I'm just curious how he picked up this connection.
Remember, this is the first time he's been to the U.S. 1970.
Yeah, see, that's the thing. And, you know, this is the day and age before the internet. So there is no chance of, like, listening to it outside of radio or something like that, especially in India, back in those days.
But he had taught Americans in his courses in Bombay.
Okay.
So he definitely had some exposure to American culture. I don't know to what degree, but he certainly, you know, the term of the time, he grokked it.
But it'll get some, it'll take some time to get used to his style. I'm just so used to Swami P and Swami SPG. It was a little bit of a struggle to get used to him. So
I believe that.
I have to do a little, but obviously the content wise, yes, it was very nice.
When he's talking,
that I also noticed was that in his later talks, probably when he was maybe 70s or something, I recently listened to that set of Indian spiritual heritage series from Swami Dayananda. I think I posted the link also on the. I think he was much older at that time. His words seems to be much more measured, and he's very slow. He probably slows down significantly compared to what he does in this talk. And one analogy that he uses. I like to understand things with analogies. And of course, the dog and the bone was one great example that he explains. But the other one was the ball of fire. The ball of fire, which was, of course, it's a classic example. But the way that Swamiji explains that, saying that, hey, you know, if it is a ball of fire, then all fire shape has to be ball in a round shape. But if it's not the case, then it is not its own intrinsic property. So it has to be someone else's intrinsic property that it is borrowed. And he says that's exactly what we also end up doing by borrowing somebody else's identity and assuming that that's our own identity. That is a very good one, actually.
Yeah, two things. Srini here. One, he was, of course, a super fast express. In fact, he was a bullet train if you compare with others. I'm also used to Swami P and Swami SPG. So he was very, very fast. That is number one. And second, of course, I could also not take the notes because I was listening while I was traveling. So, but anyway, I'm planning to do a re-listening of the entire three videos. Two things which caught up during my listening was one, the relativity of time, you know, that was very beautifully explained. He said, you can realize time when you are totally engaged in something, time flies. But when you are not engaged in something, you find that, you know, the time is slowly not moving at all. So which means that to your own experience, time is relative. Though you find that, you know, time has got the exact, second by second movement. But when you are engaged in something, time flies, but when you're not engaged in something, you know, time actually slows down. So which means that even to yourself, the time is relative. So that part of his explanation was very good. That is number one. And number two, he keeps referring to this Einstein's theory. In a couple of times, he says, you know, it is Einstein's time or Einstein's relativity. That I could not pick up. You know, if somebody, has listened to that carefully, why he was referring to Einstein, I was not very clear. So if I need to re-listen, but if somebody has really, picked up that a couple of times he makes this reference to Einstein, it is the Einstein's time and Einstein's relativity. So I need to listen again to understand this. Of course, the third point was again, he was always alternating between Sat and Chit. He says, Chit is Sat and Sat is Chit. So they're not actually two different entities. They are the same entities. Because I was also under the impression that Sat, Chit, Ananda are three different verticals, and then you need to realize. But now Alpana has actually clarified all the three is actually bundled into one, and it keeps alternating between each other. So I think that was one revelation today to me. The other thing was this reference to Einstein. I think he was saying about time. No, Einstein keeps saying time is relative. So which means that even in our experience, the time is relative. So that is what is, need to understand. So that was the small, grasping I could do for this listening. Of course, if there is one more session, we will do a pure listening and then come back. So that is what is my, take here. Thank you.
I think we should do it when we do 13th chapter.
Right.
Because it is 1, 2, 3 of that. So we should do at that time.
Yes.
Actually, he starts off the lecture with the first three verses of the 13th chapter. Yeah. So it's actually the three verses that he's actually explained, I think, in all this. Yeah.
So for those of us who did this first book, The Teachings of Swami Dayananda, the one that we started off in 2019, actually, if you recall, the entire book is probably a transcript of this particular talk. Most of the book.
But it's not this talk. That book is transcribed from talks he gave in India in 1978. Okay. But many times Swamiji's talks would evolve. He would be working on his material, and then he would get to the point where he would do a larger yajna type talk. And what that book is exactly that. It's 19 talks.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. Because that book, it's an amazing book, actually. It's so, I would say, he chooses his words so carefully, because if you miss one particular word in that, it's, of course, it's in English, and if you miss one particular word in it, you might probably miss the entire context of what he's saying.
I also think...
What's the name of the book? Sorry.
No, no.
It's called The Teachings of Swami Dayananda. I'll look it up. I'll just show you.
Thank you. Sorry, Rick, I cut you off.
No.
Uday, this is a book. I don't know if you can see it. Oh, man. How do I remove this?
No, that's all right. But you just read, please, The Teachings of Swami Dayananda, is it?
Yeah, one sec. I'll just cut it off.
Ah, okay. Teaching of Bhagavad Gita by Swami Dayananda.
By Swami Dayananda. This is the one. This is an excellent book.
Okay.
Actually, the book I was referring to is this one. Is this different?
Yeah.
This is the Bhagavad Gita 19 talks.
Oh, no, that's different. This one is...
That one. Oh, yeah. I have that too. That is different. Yeah. Sorry. I was referring to this book.
Okay. Yeah.
I know that book too, but that's not this.
Yeah.
I'll just, because we've been talking about this and it's so nice, I'll read it from my notes. And this is where Swamiji is saying, I begin, I is the subject, all else is the object, distinct from ignorance onwards. Again, including the subtle and the gross. What is the I can only be the content of the knower. I becomes known, becomes knower with something to be known. Awareness is not limited by space or time. All is known in awareness. Nothing can stand away from awareness. Therefore, space is in awareness, and everything in space is in awareness. From the I standpoint, I am not away from anything. If awareness is born, awareness is born in time. Time becomes absolute. Time is, awareness is. Anything born, an event in time, subject to change. Change is what we call death. Can you think of a birth without time? Death is in time. No experience of time in deep sleep. The moment you go to sleep, the observer of time goes to sleep. When the observer goes away, where is the discussion of time being there? In deep sleep, I dismiss time, yet I am still there very much. Awareness has to be there so that in the morning I can say I had a good sleep. Awareness never sleeps, is always wide awake. In the three states, awareness is. Time is, awareness is. Time is not, awareness is. That awareness is therefore not bound by time. Then definitely no beginning, much less having an ending. This I, awareness, is free from time. Timelessness is not in time.
No, that's a beautiful one, you know, something that I struggle with to explain to people, or even to sometimes I myself get confused about, is okay. The individual experience of deep sleep shows that awareness is there during the deep sleep, and you can reconcile to that fact that, okay, even if your body and mind is quote unquote not there or irrelevant at that point of time, the awareness is, that's a very clear personal experience everybody can relate to. But I think the confusion happens because, you know, we probably don't know what happens beyond death. And you can't relate the same experience of deep sleep to explain the death part, saying that, okay, it's a long sleep, and then you wake up again one day. So it's really hard for me to get it sometimes. And sometimes it's much more harder to explain to people as well. How do we think about it in a different way?
Natush, I don't know, you literally read my mind, because I was about to say this, that that personally, again, during this journey, it used to, like, like intellectually to some extent you could understand, but then I couldn't break through beyond a certain level of understanding, right? Beyond what you are reading and listening, I couldn't absorb it until my meditation started taking hold and became much deeper. That's when it dawned, the what is being said dawned on me, right? Until I could get those glimpses in deeper meditation, in getting those glimpses, if not, I mean, just few milliseconds, few, maybe a second here and there. But that's when it dawned on me what is being said, right? So my question, I mean, here is what I was thinking, you know, how to formulate this question. It's like, one helps with the other, right? So at least personally, meditation helped me understand this better, go a little bit beyond the basic understanding, if you will, or a more bookish knowledge, right? A little bit beyond that. It was only with meditation that I was able to do that. So I'm curious to hear from others too. It's like, how do you go beyond the intellectual understanding into a realm where it's more deeper? So as you pointed out, like, I think, Uday, I think you said, the way Swamiji talks about the subject, there's no doubt, there's absolute conviction, right? Because there's no doubt at all. And that's why he's able to go and talk to an audience without preparation, because all this is just coming, flowing through him, right? There is no need to prepare. It's very, very, he's internalized it so much. How do we get to that level of internalization, right? So to me, that happened because of meditation. At least the consciousness, awareness part of it became clear only after my meditation started taking hold.
Hey, Rajesh, I'm just going back to your question. You're trying to correlate death to sleep.
Here's a problem that I'm trying to solve, right? Sometimes, like, you know, what Kishore says, sometimes I'm clear what this thing is. Sometimes I get confused, and especially more so when I explain to, let's say, someone who's not even aware of what the Vedanta is. And if you were to explain this in the form of examples to them, in terms of something that they can relate with their personal examples, I find a little short of words, or short of my ability to explain this concept that people can relate to much better.
Neti is the other way.
Yeah. So for example, if you want to say, you know, that, you know, the if you want to explain the concept of mithya, right? There are multiple examples. Like, you know, you can say a mirage in the water, water in the mirage as an example, or blue sky as an example. You can explain that, and you can sort of, you know, help people understand that what is apparent is really not true. Okay, that it's possible to explain that. But where I fail to explain consistently is this part. How do you explain death is an event in time, and you're saying awareness is beyond death? How do you explain that to someone so that the person can relate to it? That's the problem that I'm trying to solve.
Yeah, but don't correlate it to sleep is what I'm trying to say. Why are you correlating death to sleep there? See, those are through.
So what would you correlate it with? That's the question. The question is, what would you, give an example, how do you explain that?
Well, I think also we talk about sleep so to make the point that consciousness, awareness always is. Awareness yeah. plus waking state, waking of the world and the mind, awareness relative to sleep, dream, the mind is active in deep sleep, no in, no out, but yet I remain. So that can, I think, in some ways be a microcosm for life daily and death, because in death, no more world, no more individual, but awareness, which wasn't born, isn't going to die. Now, first of all, I don't think anyone, we're responsible to have that discussion with anybody. I really don't. I go back to Vedanta deals with three questions. Who am I? What is the nature of the world? Who or what is the Lord? And if you can deal with those, if you can be free while living, then death is its own, whatever it is. What requires us to be able to knowledgeably discuss that? I don't see the pressure. Rajesh, does that make sense?
No, Rick, if you go back to even Swami Dayananda's lecture that we listened, right? And he keeps saying, everyone wants to live one more day, yes. one more day, one more day. Yeah. See, what I'm saying is that whether we like it or not, there is a perceived event in our life which says, okay, there is a birth, there's a death. Now, using examples, it's very hard to explain saying that you exist even after death. It's very hard to explain that. And where I'm struggling is there some good example that we can explain to people that, oh, it seems intellectually makes sense, right? And then maybe, it makes sense, but I don't think it's still true. But then maybe there is something in it. I want to get some examples that would help me articulate it myself better. And so it's easier for me to do that.
I don't have a response for that, but I will say this. When Swamiji is talking about you want to live one more day, he's showing that we have confused our nature with the body. We think in terms of the body living one more day, but the reason we can't accept the death of the body is because as awareness, as sat, chit, anantam, we are birthless and deathless. That's what's to be understood. On one level, this life itself, how do you begin to explain this apparent limitation within the limitless? How are you going to explain the death of the limited? I don't know that, again, we really have to do that. It's enough to wake up now.
Rick, that's how I have resolved it in my mind, in terms of saying that, okay, when a death happens, it happens for something else that you are not. Okay. But what I'm saying is that for someone who does not have a background, it's really hard to explain, at least for me. That's what I'm saying.
So how about going in that direction as well, right? That's what I was thinking, that taking the example of electricity and different appliances, that, your fridge gets bad, you replace it with the other one. The electricity continues and there's an apparatus which can change. Now, do we really need to link that it is the same fridge in a different avatar? Or it doesn't need to be, right? Because you are the electricity. So the moment you try to take the focus away from that, you are not the apparatus. You are actually the electricity. So that sometimes works, because ultimately that's what we need to do, right? That you are not the body. So that
Drik Drishya Vive.
You're not the car, my body, same thing. So you're not that. And then relating them to any instrument. It's just a change of an instrument for the body consciousness. So, because karma theory also not everybody believes, right? So, go into reincarnation, you are bound to get sucked into it. So, might as well not talk about it, that it's a change in apparatus.
Yeah.
If people are worried, oh, what I do now and that world is not fair and this and that, then you bring in karma theory. Otherwise, you don't.
Yeah. So the reason why I asked this question was, something happened to someone and, someone passed away in their family and they somehow seemed to have read my book and they called me and I had a long chat with them. And it is really hard for me to explain to them saying that whoever passed away is, what's their perception of who passed away and what the perception of who really passed away. It was really hard for me to explain. They said, I think you're asking me to have faith. I don't think I can have faith. I'm trained in science. I said, okay, fine. And I just moved on from that. But I had that conversation with the person and I was not able to convince that particular person that, I tried giving different examples. Think of that this person has gone on a long break and he'll come back again. He or she will come back again at some time. Nothing was able to, help them understand because they were not coming from the quote-unquote the neti-neti concept or the drip-drishya viveka or understanding of Sachidananda concept and the awareness concept, right? So it is, they were coming from, okay, what I see is what I get kind of a mentality. But it's really hard for me to explain. That's why I'm struggling.
Just to answer Kishore, in fact, today's class was totally on, what you were trying to, understand. It was a Vedanta Sara class. And then Swami P was speaking about the methods to do Nidityasana. So he was very clearly saying that the only way to come out of this intellect is by sheer practice. So he says, you can do the meditation. Maybe, meditation also, you may sit in a place, you may do it only for a particular period of time, which is okay. You can follow the Ashtanga Yoga, you can do the meditation. But again, in the meditation, don't lock your mind, but do the Vedantic meditation. Keep asking yourself, who is Brahman? What is the relationship between me and Brahman? The Jagat Mithya, and then Atma and Paramatma's IKM. So he keeps saying, whatever posture you follow, wherever you are, keep your mind clear and then keep on imposing this, truth onto yourself. So it is nothing but abhyasa and practice only. There is no other method. The only method to get above the intellect level is the method of practice, which is Vedantic meditation, which can be done anywhere. He was going to the extent of saying, you're sitting in a car, you're sitting in the office, you're walking, your morning walks, while eating, you make your mind clear and then, keep pushing this, which of course, as you said, is very difficult, but still that is the only way to do it. So that is one. Second, what he says is Shravana Manana Nidityasanam is there. So Shravanam is the most important thing to do. He says, listening is the most important activity which is required. Because once the, mananam is only your logical conclusion. So once you start listening and you are convinced, you start doing Nidityasanam while listening itself. So which means that there is no separate session for Nidityasanam. While doing Shravanam, because you are convinced in the mananam, your Nidityasanam and the Shravanam will go together. So he was going to the extent of saying, that is why we have this class, where I improve my Nidityasanam by teaching you. You improve your Nidityasanam by focusing your entire mind that 1 hour in this class, without getting any distractions. And we interact together. So that is why, these classes are more important. Of course, he was very clear, either you can do it face to face or you can also, listen to his recordings or whatever. But he says the most important thing is to keep on listening again and again. So the ultimate, path is Shravanam and Nidityasanam merging together, and 24/7, you keep thinking of this. So maybe at some point of time, you will suddenly get the flash of realization. So I thought I will answer that now, because today's class was very relevant to that. Thank you.
Wonderful, yeah.
Thank you.
Ashish.
Just to add to what Srini is saying, right? Somebody was just telling me the other day that, you know, you take the example of Parikshit in Bhagavatam, right? So Parikshit actually listened to the discourse for 7 full days, right? And the only thing that he did was he did it with utmost sincerity and he got liberated. It's not that he acquired the knowledge and he started working on it and then, you know, he achieved liberation, right? Just the act of Shravanam that you mentioned right now, of listening to the Bhagavatam, you know, with intensity and sincerity. I think that is the point there, you know. Even Sathya Sai Baba used to say, you know, all that is required, you know, is sincerity in your approach to spirituality, right? Everything else will be taken care of. And this example of Parikshit was Shravanam alone, which led to liberation. So that's what I just thought I'll share. Yeah, thank you.
Ashish. Ashish, if you're speaking, we can't hear you. Type something, Ashish.
No, it looks like he's on a call. That's what it's showing here. Maybe Rick can.
He raised his.
Sure.
That's all good.
You know, we all know Shankara's the hair on fire story. And that's essentially, you may lack all the qualities, but if you desire liberation above all else, you will get liberated. And I believe it is that way. I also wanted to say to what Kishori was talking about, I don't know, for me anyway, what's most accessible is awareness, because I find myself aware. And to me, so much of the practice is noticing that whatever thoughts are in the mind, awareness is not defined or confined by those thoughts. The more I notice that, the sting of the mind, the sting of the personality just goes away, because there's really no one to be stung. There's only awareness. And that's the most evident and requires no effort. We find ourselves aware. It is self-evident. It is self-revealing. And if we really look at all, and you know, we've seen the body change continuously. We've seen the mind, the likes and dislikes change continuously. But that sense that awareness has not changed, to me, that's the easiest to latch onto relative to this.
Absolutely agree, Rick. I mean, I feel the same. And that's the one concept that I could at least get. And the way he explained it, and you know, that reinforced it for me. But what I meant was, for years I struggled with it until I started meditating, and that's when it actually connected for me, right? And because in meditation, you're observing your thoughts and you're doing it again and again and again. And you see that you're not your mind, you're not your body, and you're the observer. So being that witness, even a pure witness, even for a few moments, and to see that it is detached from mind and body was what was needed for me personally, to kind of relate it to what I was then listening to. And connect it. And because until then it was a concept, it was conceptual and intellectual, but not something that I could own and say with conviction. But now I can. But that connection happened in meditation, is what I was trying to get at. But now, if you then, like in my case, for instance, if I then what is needed to be able to meditate, right? If you really think about it, if I were to take that path, and then you say, okay, to understand this, and then you need to be able to meditate, then what does it take to be able to meditate? You already need a somewhat calmer mind, a mind that's not agitated, that's relatively in equipoise, right? In a centered mind is needed to be able to meditate. It's an advanced practice. It's just not possible for meditation is not easy. Let's put it that way. It's one of the toughest things one can do. So how do you then, if you walk back from them, how do you get a calm mind? And then you go down that path and see that even for a half an hour of meditation, it's important to see what you do the other 23 and a half hours. Because that's what is going to determine if your mind is going to be relatively calm or not. Because you are faced with situations, you are in the midst of all kinds of situations, day in and day out. So when all this is coming in, and then there's obviously turmoil inside yourself as well from past experiences, how do you then get to a part where the mind is relatively calm so you can meditate? Hence, you can understand what is being said, right? So eventually, what I came to the conclusion, at least it's working for me, is basically that part is mental preparation, right? And that part relates to that. It's all mental preparation. So to me, it became that part became the yogic practice became that part to bring the mind to a relatively calm state. And that's the whole point of yoga, is how I saw it. And then Vedanta is where it connects back into even higher part from there. From you are able to launch from there because the mind is now relatively calm. So that's how I kind of related for me. So until then, it was very intellectual for me. But this brought in a daily practice because I can continue to work on this on a daily, moment-by-moment basis.
Yeah, sorry, Kishore, there is an answer for this also. He says you can use the meditative practice also to do the Vedantic meditation.
Correct.
Which means that instead of blocking the mind in the meditating state, you know, you keep analyzing, you know, your Brahman, you know, right. Your Mithya, keep doing this. But what he says is, see, it all depends upon person to person, because now we are tuned to meditation. It may not be possible for you to sit for the entire day on meditation. Okay. He also says the other thing is also not easy. I mean, like you said, the thought process is going to be there for the next 23 hours. Maybe for 1 hour you're doing a meditation, maybe 7 hours you sleep, 15 hours you need to keep thinking and you need to run your life. But he says the practice should be such that you bring this from your conscious mind and put it into your subconscious mind. Subconscious mind is the mind, you know, where the voluntary actions keep happening. So he says you should have this, idea to take it from the conscious mind and put it in your subconscious mind, which means that your conscious mind is doing your daily transactions and your subconscious mind from behind keeps on prompting you that, you know, I am Brahman, world is Mithya. 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 No, this thing should keep on, you know, coming at the background. Maybe initially it becomes like an, you know, very mundane exercise. But over a period of time, he says it will mature and this echo will keep happening in you for eternal. So that is what he was trying to say in today's lecture. The next lecture is, I think, what is related to you. He is going to teach us how to do this Vedantic meditation as a meditation, like, you know, in the Ashtanga Yoga or Nirvikalpa Samadhi or, Savikalpa Samadhi and Nirvikalpa Samadhi is the next topic which he is going to do next week. So I think there lies the answer.
Yeah.
It means that, you know, it depends upon your own, swabhava or personality, as we call. So whichever is good for you, you can do. Which means that what you are doing right now is the perfect thing to do, which is suiting your swabhava, which you can continue to do, but take the shift from trying to attain a samadhi to trying to understand the knowledge. So he says knowledge and awareness is the final truth.
No, so, thank you, Srini.
I'm only repeating what he's saying, you know. So I'm not inventing something, but
of course,
today's class was so good that I thought I should share that here because it was relevant to the question what you asked.
Yeah.
Sorry, Rick, we are deviating from, the original topic.
If I may just add to that, I'll just say there is this, in general, in meditation, we are not trying to suppress anything. Like literally, I'm saying this, no matter what, obviously there are different types of meditations and whatnot, it doesn't matter. However, we don't suppress anything, right? thoughts come. I mean, there is this misconception in some, I think, that saying that yogis try to suppress thoughts or separate. I mean, that is some literature. I've seen it. You're literally not. You're letting thoughts come by. Yes, eventually it will stop because you're observing it. Yeah, but you know, but we're not trying to suppress, right? We're trying to stay in the present moment, observing your thoughts as a witness. The way I understand then is just like Swamiji mentioned, Swami Dayananda mentioned in his talks, as you cut and the time, as you keep going down, you cannot, you know, with time you can keep breaking it down again and again. But what remains there, eventually you'll come to the understanding that to be present means that you're one with your original nature. That's the only way to be present, like right then and there, because you can't say I'm here for 1 second or, and then you can be broken down again, right? So it'll come down to that if you say that you're present, you're meaning it really means that you are one with your original nature as that witness. So we are not definitely trying to suppress anything, suppress thoughts or anything like that. You know, there are techniques for sure. And Vedantic meditation is yet another way of absorbing this knowledge. Yeah, no, thank you. Thank you for sharing that.
Yeah. See, one more, you know, analogy which Rajesh was asking. You know, today, Swami P had a very good analogy. He says, you know, knowledge will take you to a different place. So he says, people living in the slums of Chennai, you know, they are given better accommodation at a different place, okay? Saying that, you know, their accommodation is not good today. But ultimately, after, you know, a couple of months, they come back to the original accommodation. So that is what happens. So the knowledge will take you to that higher level, will give you a better, you know, thinking process, will take you to that intellectual level. But ultimately, your samsara, swabhava will pull you back to the original level, which you need to stop. So that is what he was trying to refer. Once you go to that higher level, you need to be, you know, having that abhimana, or he says that pride, that I am at the higher level, and you need to retain that higher level. So, which again requires tremendous practice. And again, he is very clear in saying that it differs from individual to individual. The final journey or the ultimate journey is your own. All the knowledge you can take from different groups, different people, different teachings, but the final journey, you're alone. That's all. You need to do it alone.
And the 15 hours that is not sleep or meditation is all antakarana shuddhi, which is all preparation too, right? Isn't that the point? And it's that same preparation that serves you in shravanam, and being able to listen and not be distracted. In a way, I understand, you know, I myself am the same victim that we talked about with listening to these talks by Swamiji, Swami Dayananda. They are, it's a vision talk. And I want to say, though, I think everyone here understands that vision well enough that they weren't distracted. They were in that moment, in that vision. And that's the point. And then you reflect on it. But I think that's also the benefit of taking notes, because you take the notes, you look at them, and it puts you right back where you were when the talk was happening. And that's the nididhyasanam. So it all comes back to a recognition of what it is, what's happening, what you want. And as Swamiji says, this, you go back just because of habit, and you go back just because there's a certain habit to it, a certain use to it, but you don't accept it. You're not accepting it even when you're living it. So having been exposed to a higher truth of who we are, you don't have to be fearful of it. You just have to throw yourself with abandon into the journey. The journey will take you home.
In fact, Swami Chinmayananda is also, you know, very, very powerful and, you know, deep talks. Mm-hmm. He's putting his, you know, thoughts in a very, very, powerful, and same thing Swami Dayananda also does. But Paramarthananda has got his own flow, na? So he slowly, you know, opens your mind and puts the thoughts there. But Dayananda likes, you know, hits you like the bullet, which keeps piercing into your head. And same thing happens to, you know, with Swami Chinmayananda also. I keep listening to some lectures. they're all very powerful, very articulate, and also, you know, what to say, the energy levels are very, very high with Swami Chinmayananda and Swami Dayananda. But the other Swamis are a little bit, you know, slow and calm. So that is the difference I found. Because of the bullet train speed, I couldn't take notes. But definitely, I will go back, you know, and take the notes, and we can come back on this strongly. Thank you. Thank you, Rick. Thank you.
I will say, whether we come back to this or not, I really would hope that everyone would, after having spent this time, go back and listen again. Whatever you do with it, it will be different for you. I guarantee it.
Yeah. So we got one more minute. Ashish, do you want to try unmuting yourself and saying what you wanted to say?
Yeah, Rajesh, what I was trying to say, I have forgotten, but I think I was trying to answer your question. I don't have an answer, but I have an argument. So, and the argument is why is sleep not parallel to death? Because you basically fold everything in, and then when you wake up in the morning, you open your cupboards and then take out everything, all the relations and everything. And somehow you remember that you have to start again, your personal life, professional life. In case of probably death, you don't remember. So that's the only difference. It's a argument, but yeah, it's not an answer to your question. Not enough to convince anyone else who has this question.
Thank you. But good reminder that, you know, wearing clothes in the morning. Good reminder. Yeah. All right. So we're right on
time. Time for next class.
It's awesome. No, today we don't have a class today because of Thanksgiving. It's on.
Next week, what are we going to do?
Next week, yeah. Next week, I think we should do Chapter 9 revisions now. So let's plan for it. 2 minutes to the entire 1.5 hours. You decide based on what your plan is for Chapter 9 revisions. But let's revise Chapter 9 starting next week.
Yeah, I'll miss next week, but I'll be there a week after. So.
No problem.
I also will miss next week.
Okay.
We'll be there the week after, out of town.
Okay.